Hello, and welcome to the Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Boris FX and our sponsor, Jump Desktop. I'm Steve Hallfish, ACE. I'm a working film, TV, and documentary editor. Over the last 9 years, I've done more than 400 interviews with the world's best editors. I've been using Boris FX products for almost 30 years, and I'm proud to partner with them to bring you some great filmmaking content. Today on Art of the Cut, we're talking with Oscar-winning editor Zach Steinberg, ACE, about editing John Woo's latest film, Silent Night. Zach won an Oscar and an Ace Eddie for the original Matrix film. He's also been nominated for an Emmy and won an Ace Eddie for Gotti. His other work includes Ava, Pacific Rim Uprising, Speed Racer, Matrix Reloaded, Matrix Revolutions, and Police Academy. Before I hop into our discussion with Zach, a brief thank you to our sponsors. Jump Desktop is a high-performance and secure app that lets you virtually connect to your editing bay as if you were physically there. Keep all your assets in one place and connect to your powerful editing bays from anywhere. Jump Desktop's high-performance remote desktop protocol lets you edit from any low-powered laptop. With end-to-end encryption, native support for macOS and Windows, and multi-monitor support, you can be productive from anywhere. Jump Desktop also has collaborative screen sharing for collaboration with your team. See what thousands of editors have been using to get their work done from across the world. Visit jumpdesktop.com/cut to begin your free no-limits 14-day trial today. And to our partner, Boris FX. I've been using Boris FX and Sapphire for almost 30 years, so they're not just a sponsor to me. I feel like they've been a partner in my cutting room for decades, helping me to deliver on the creative vision of my clients, directors, and producers. For all of us, our work is about bringing a creative idea to the screen, and for me, Boris FX is one of the important tools that I use to do that. To see how they can help you on your latest project, head on over to borisfx.com and check out the Boris FX suite, which includes Sapphire, Continuum, Mocha Pro, Silhouette, and Optics, all in a low-cost monthly or annual subscription. If you want to read this interview with great visual support, you can go to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC. That site also has other great filmmaking content, so keep that bookmark. And now, Zach Steinberg, ACE, discusses editing John Woo's Silent Night. So this movie is famously no dialogue. What does that mean? If there's no dialogue, do you as an editor have to rely on something else that you wouldn't normally rely on? Like, I don't know, sound or the direction or shot choice or something to help better tell the story?
I was initially totally sucked in by two things. The fact that it was directed by John Woo, who I kind of rever, and the fact that there was no dialogue. Because in theory, I felt like it's a potential just to make something that's pure cinema. You're making a silent film, essentially. Obviously, the difference is it has lots of sound. It has, I think, a pretty great sound job, great mix, great score. But I didn't really know how it would play out when I first started working on it. And what it turns out in retrospect, the three things that are most important are first of all, the direction itself, where you have to communicate so much through the camera. And I know that's kind of a subjective comment. I don't know. And it's very hard to quantify. But I just feel like when you look at directors overall, there are just some directors who communicate a lot through the camera. Some directors who rely more on the text of the script to get the point across. You know, I think a guy like George Miller is someone I would say communicates hugely through the camera. I think Spielberg kind of set the bar for everybody. No one's any better than him.
I talked to Paul Hirsch about Brian De Palma being like that. He really doesn't rely on setups.
Yes.
He relies on very specific camera direction and blocking. You don't get setups.
When I started working in movies, I had a degree in comm arts from University of Wisconsin in Madison. I love movies. That's about it. I hadn't really taken any production classes. I drifted down to Chicago and I started working in commercials and industrials. I thought I'd give it a shot just to learn the ropes. And it turned out to be a really good idea because the physical processes are very much the same in making a commercial and making a feature length film or a television show. So I did that for about a year. I freelanced in commercial production, mostly in actual production, though, no post-production. 20th Century Fox came to town on a Brian De Palma film called The Fury, with Amy Irving and John Cassavetes. I think it's one of Brian's more minor films, but it was important to me. And I got a job on it as a PA. I worked my butt off and I loved it and I was doing great with it. I wanted to go to dailies. Brian had a policy of closed dailies. One day I'm in the production office and the phone rings and I answer it. It's Paul Hirsch's assistant in New York. We were shooting in Chicago. They were editing in New York. They did not come on location. She was saying to me, listen, I don't know if there's anyone that can help us, but I work for Paul Hirsch. He's the editor of the film. He'd like a little more communication with Brian about how Brian feels about the dailies. Is there anybody who could go to dailies and sit next to Brian and make...
And
I said, I would love to do that. I can do it. So she and I, but mostly her, worked out a little form. She ran it by Paul. They ran it by Brian. Brian approved it. 2 days later, I'm sitting between Brian and the DP, a guy named Richard Klein, who was a very well-known DP at the time. And for the rest of the show, I'm making notes. And what was the amazing thing was all day long, I'd be working on the set as a PA. I'd be working with extras. I'd be like maybe a third AD. Sometimes I'd be lugging camera stuff around, or sometimes I'd be clearing locations. Then I would sit next to Brian and take these notes. And I realized that once the shooting's over, Brian and this guy, Paul Hirsch, are going to be sitting together and actually making this movie. That's when the light went off in my head. And I said, that's what I want to do.
Is that how you met the Wachowskis in Chicago?
No. I was already living out here for quite a while. And I just met them on a meeting for Bound. I was lucky that someone I'd become friends with, who was a production designer, was going to do Bound and recommended me to them. And they expressed an interest in meeting me. So
you also mentioned how important sound was, and the sound design under, especially like the opening credits, is where one of the places where I noticed it was fantastic. Right. Can you talk to me about how much of that you try to at least sketch out in your picture cut?
I had two really, really good assistants, Brent McReynolds and Sam Schlenker. They both had complementary skill sets, you know, in terms of what they were good at. But between the two of them, they're really excellent at sound, music, and visual effects, which is what I really look for now when I'm putting a crew together. But yes, we did have a lot of pretty well-developed sound in there. Nothing nearly as good as what ended up in the final. Mark Steckinger was the sound designer on it. He's quite good. Recently, he's probably best known for doing John Wick, all the John Wick movies. But he's a terrific guy. We mixed it over at Fox with David Giammarco, who's one of my favorite mixers. Interestingly, it was a one-man mix, which I've always wanted to try. Since we had no dialogue, we really could sort of give up a mixer, no trouble. Dave was doing sound effects and music. Typically, you have someone who's doing dialogue and music, and the other guy sound effects. We just sort of shifted it around a little bit, and Dave did the whole show. It was very wonderful. It was really very much of a little handcrafted show. But kind of circling back to what you were saying before, so John Woo was one of the best guys at telling the story through the camera. That's one of the key factors I find in retrospect. The other one is the actors themselves have to really, really buy into it, especially Joel Kinnaman and Catalina Moreno, how you express yourself visually. I also like to think it's one of the most important things cinematically. And then the third thing is the shot selection. How the movie is edited is really, and which is what attracted me so much, is the possibility of doing it. I've never worked on a movie that's gotten such wildly divergent reviews. We have maybe a dozen or 20 all-star reviews. I'm so proud of them and I love so much. We've also gotten some real hater reviews. I think it's because I always called the movie an art film in a genre package. And the genre is a very simple, obvious revenge film. I think so many people today are trained just to see the genre. They have trouble going beyond the boundary lines, getting out of the box a little bit. And if you just look at the genre, it's not a great idea, particularly. I mean, it's a great idea for what it is, but it's an idea we've all seen before. It's nothing special about it. You have people who view movies that way. I think we're living in a kind of an interesting time that way in terms of how audiences view movies. I think they've gotten a little bit retrained in a bad way.
They go into this movie knowing it's going to be John Woo, first of all, so you're expecting a certain thing. Right. And you're also expecting from the trailer an action movie. The movie starts, as it should, getting to know the characters and the setup and feeling something for the characters. How long can you stay in that point of sorrow that starts the movie? When do you know as an editor, I've got enough of this that people will relate to and feel and care for my characters, but we're not going to dwell on this?
There, I give a lot of credit to the structure of the script, because you don't really get into the sorrow. I'd have to actually look at a timeline on the Avid, but I'm guessing it's about 15 minutes in. You know, it starts with that running chase sequence that you just alluded to, you know, where Joel Kinnaman is trying to run down the bad guys, ends up with a really fun sequence with a car flip. He goes into the hospital. There's a really graphically bloody and beautiful scene. That's all kind of an action scene. So you've set the audience up to know that we're expecting action. So that kind of buys you a lot of license for what you just asked for about the time it takes to develop character. Then we spend a long time, good 20 minutes, 25 minutes developing character, seeing him train and doing the character through his training and learning about him.
The structure of it with an action-packed beginning allows you to sit for a bit.
Yes, I think so.
In the Sarwa. Yeah, that totally makes sense. I'm trying to remember, were there freeze frames in the hospital with the wife on her eyes, I think?
One of the pleasures there were, it's funny, it's interesting that you noticed that. One of the real pleasures of working with John is that he is an amazing cineast. He loves movies. He references them all the time in terms of what he's trying to do. When Catalina comes into the hospital looking for her husband, he had shot a number of setups of her in the hall, goes to the front desk, goes to the hallway, goes down another hallway. I thought maybe I wasn't on location. I thought maybe they had something else in mind. They abandoned it. Anyway, I picked the best shot and I used it. When I showed it to John, he loved it. And he said, when she goes to the hospital, we had those other shots. I said, yeah, quite honestly, I was a little bit confused as to how they were supposed to be used. He said, well, I was thinking what we would do is use it, then do a kind of a push in and a freeze frame. And I look at him, I'm kind of puzzled thinking, I want to try whatever you want. But he sees I'm puzzled and he tries to explain it further. And he finally says, you know, like they did in Jules and Jim. And of course, that I understood it right away. I actually went back and pulled up Jules and Jim, the part. And we worked on it quite a bit in the editing room, myself and the assistants. We really played a lot with how we moved into the eye. There's a lot of really, really delicate work in there. I mean, it looks pretty straightforward, but how we move in, there's a little lens distortion. There's all kinds of interesting stuff in there. And the timing of how long you stay on it, really played with it for a very long time. It's funny. It's something I feel like I learned. One of the last movies I was an assistant on, I was on George Miller's episode of The Twilight Zone for Spielberg. And I always say that George Miller episode, which is A Man on the Wing of the Plane, is probably the best 20-minute short I've ever made. It's just fantastic. I mean, I love that kind of filmmaking. When John Lithgow sees the creature in the stormy sky, he actually had the guys on the set build a little prosthetic where you could pump air and the eyes bulged. It looked so hokey. The crew was thinking, what is this guy doing? He spent like an hour and a half shooting it. He shot it at 18 frames, 20 frames, at 16 frames, at 40 frames, at 90 frames. He shot it closer and wider, and he shot it zooming in. He came in, he looked through all the material with the editors, Howard Smith, and he picked two frames that he liked, and he put them in the cut for when the guys went, and it's just the perfect two frames. I learned a lot from him in general. I really liked working on that movie because of George. As I retell you the story now about working on that little hallway, it just reminded me of that all of a sudden. I realized I had that in my old education.
There's a story that somebody was telling me, I think it was Kirk Baxter on Mank, where he watched a setup that was just weird. And he's like, this isn't in Fincher's visual vocabulary.
Right.
Like, it's just not right. But he watched the whole thing and he saw one moment of the conversation that he was like, that's why he did it. It's that one little moment is all he's expecting. And sure enough, that was what was true.
That's right.
I just want this.
That's right.
Out of the soul shot.
That's right.
It's so interesting. You mentioned Wu was a cineast and references film all the time. Do you have to keep up with that? Is that something you like got to go, oh, I don't know what that movie is, or I promise I'll watch that tonight?
I have a running list when John mentions movies to me. I'm a bit of a cineast myself. John is a big fan of the French New Wave, even more than me. I've actually been, in the time I've been, we're working on our second movie together now, and I've been catching up on my French New Wave and that period, 70s, 80s, French filmmaking, movies that are kind of famous for most people, like Le Samurai, Le Professionnel with Belmondo. It's often more of a bonding thing because it's such a pleasure to be working with someone who just loves cinema. You know, we had another moment in the movie where Godlock, the main character, is coming out of a hardware store. He sees the bad guy. He pulls out a knife you think he's going to throw the knife, and he almost has an opportunity, but there's kids around, and he doesn't do it, and he resheathes the knife. I was sort of putting it together, and John was happy. He says, you know, the way I want the sound in that, do you know this scene and all that jazz when he's reading the script? I said, of course, it's one of my favorite scenes in movies. The sound in that loosely comes from that All That Jazz scene, the whole idea of everything going away. He just, his own internal sound is in his own head. And my assistants felt the same way. They loved it too. Everyone, we all, as a crew, we'd get so excited at those moments.
The beginning of the movie doesn't really show the death, and you see the death in a flashback.
Right.
To me, as an editor, especially since there's no dialogue, you could put that almost anywhere. Was it where it was scripted?
That is where it was scripted, yeah. I think it's good, though, too, because once again, going back to your original question about the structure of the film, where I mentioned you have this action scene, which is also an intrigue scene. You know, what is this about? Because the death then becomes a little mini action scene a bit later, and it kind of interrupts the character. He's sitting mourning. We do this many times in the movie where we go back in time with our character. He's remembering something. It comes out of a character moment, but it becomes a little action scene. So it's a good way of peppering that through the movie. The writer, Robert Lynn, he really worked on the script hard.
Pacing a training montage. So early on, I think you alluded to this earlier, that you got a training montage.
Right.
What's the keys? How do you decide when enough is enough? Is it based on music? Do you cut those training montages with music or without them?
I never edit with music. Like, never. The only even minimal exception would be if the scene is designed to have a certain song in it, at a certain point earlier than I typically will, I'll put the music in just to see how it's feeling. Not to get pretentious about editing or anything, but I think great editing has a tremendous amount of musicality to it.
Oh, 100%.
One of the compliments that I treasure was from a composer some years ago, that so many composers now kind of write music that kind of floats. This is something I share in common with Paul Hirsch. He and I have talked about this. In fact, I borrowed this expression from Paul. I like music that's kind of shrink-wrapped, that kind of wraps around the action, underlines it, leaves room, works hard with the score. A lot of more old-fashioned composers would have their music editor break down the cuts of a movie and then try and figure out what time signature they're going to write in. The composer told me he had the hardest time figuring out the time signature. But once he found it, he said every cut hit.
Wow.
I was gratified to hear that, because to me that kind of proves what I'm saying to you, is that I think there is a musicality. So I think if you want to turn off the sound, I also say there's another thing I learned from George Miller when on the Twilight Zone episode that I alluded to earlier. George would come in at least once a week and he would just turn off all the sound and watch the movie. And it was a full dialogue thing. He just wanted to watch the cuts. Mm-hmm. I highly recommend it. I've come in to fix a few movies that have been done by more inexperienced directors and editors. And I say the first thing I'm going to do to the directors, I'm going to take out all the music. And they're all freaked out. And every time I've done it, they've all said to me at the end, I'm always going to do it this way. This is the way to do it. If your cut is playing just as a cut, then the music is enhancing it. If you try to work with music right away, I think you're kind of hobbling yourself. And if something's worth working, you don't have any incentive to make it better. A good composer will always figure out a way to make the music work for what you're doing.
Once you realize you have to recut something, you have to do it without the music, because otherwise, subconsciously, the music is telling you, no, you can't cut here. You're in the middle of a musical phrase when you should be cutting based on the visuals.
That's exactly my point about how having especially successful temp music in there and using it hobbles you. I love working with temp music eventually. I usually don't do it until I've got a really solid cut of the movie, though. So much of editing is just in your gut. The best way to learn about how to do those kind of things is to watch movies that you think are great. Really, really just study them.
I read a really interesting psychology paper that said intuition, which is that gut, right, cutting from your gut, is really a hidden version of insight. In other words, you have intuition because you've watched all these movies and internalized mm-hmm. them, felt the patterns, and are able to right. know when those patterns match your patterns.
Right, right.
That's exactly what the intuition is.
I try to explain that to people a lot, especially to assistants who are interested in trying to figure out things. I always tell them two things they should do. They should watch Jaws like six times in a row.
Okay, Jaws specifically. All right.
I just think that movie is so well done, you know? I mean, you may not love it overall, but it's so well done. And the more you watch it, the more you realize all the tricks between Spielberg and then Verna Fields, what they were doing, both using the camera. And the other thing I like to say is watch every Hal Ashby movie from The Landlord through Being There, right? And watch them in order if you can. He's kind of one of my personal heroes. He was an editor. He won an Academy Award for In the Heat of the Night. He edited a lot of stuff for Norman Jewison. And then Norman Jewison gave him his first break on The Landlord to direct. His movies are sublimely edited, I think. I learned a lot just by watching Hal Ashby movies. I was also lucky enough to work briefly for Hal.
How is it different to edit the gun training montage than the kind of body training montage?
You know, it's funny. The whole montage thing was the part of the movie that was probably in the biggest flux. I mean, where we were moving scenes around. Because it was about character. You know, I like to say when you're editing a movie, you know, we all understand this. We work on a scene and we make it right. We get it to where we like it. And then we put that in with a larger group of scenes and you have to adjust things to make it work again. Then you put it into an act or something, et cetera, all the way out to the expanding that idea out, all the way out to the finished movie. So if you look at the whole training sequence, both the physical training, the gun training, the car driving training as one thing. That was a good example of that, where I got them all where I liked them as units. And then we combination started moving the units around because you're trying to establish a kind of an emotional tension and a dramatic tension and keeping the audience involved for all that time. And then all of a sudden scenes felt like they were too long, typically.
The other thought that occurred to me when you were talking about seeing things in context is how long you can be in a tonal place. The father is so angry. He's so bitter. How long can you stay bitter before having a moment of tenderness, for example, between the husband and the wife?
Right.
And where do those come in? And feeling that kind of stuff, separate from the cut feeling.
No, that's just something you have to feel. And you're absolutely right on it. The majority of that structurally overall was in place from the script. I give Robert Lynn a lot of credit for that. What I had to do as the editor was make sure that, let's say you're doing anger between two emotional beats, which are on a timeline as written, but the anger part could either be 20 minutes or 14 minutes, you know? That's where you have to exercise the kind of control that I think you were asking about.
When you're watching dailies for the big action scenes, are you looking for also like kinetic camera moments? How are you kind of harvesting what you're watching when you're watching dailies for action?
I love camera moments. And that's one thing I love about John. He doesn't shoot a lot of masters. The camera's always moving. Michael Kahn once made this comment to me about a cut. We were talking about a specific cut when we were looking at stuff on The Twilight Zone, where he was editing Spielberg's sequence. And he referred to the cut as flicking the eye. And I always took that to mean if something happens in front of your eye and you pick that motion up on the next cut and it kind of flicks you into it. I always look for little things like that, whether it's a simple thing like, you know, a left to right movement that you can continue, or you're pushing a certain way, or a certain kinetic energy that can cross a cut. Even sometimes on a simple little dialogue scene, there's often little things like that that make a cut so much more interesting.
I think I have an example in this film that I might offer, and I was interested whether it was scripted or not, was the cut from the door handle of the car to the door handle of the house.
No, that wasn't scripted.
I loved it.
Thank you.
But it gave that connectivity.
Yes.
To the two scenes.
No, I do look for things like that. I always arrange the dailies into, I think it comes from being a film editor. I arrange them like I used to arrange camera rolls. Or if I had moviola rolls, I would set them up in sort of little groups. I still arrange my bins that way. I sort of show my assistants how I like them, and they usually get it pretty good, and then I'll tweak them a little bit. Where the film fits in the group, obviously, is the most important thing, you know, because it has to fit along a timeline.
Do you bother doing an actual chem roll where you string stuff together and whatever it is, all the setups or something?
I know people who do, but I don't do that. I use markers a lot, locators for things I want. But, you know, it's so easy to find stuff in the Avid. I like the process of continually looking through the material. You really can't mark everything. And particularly with an action scene, as the scene starts taking shape, and then I'm looking for a moment, right? So I'm looking through all the material. I'm trying to find something that'll work for that moment. But sometimes I'll find, oh, that other moment, I bet I should use that instead of something I have in there. Because once you have the scene already cut, all of a sudden something that was just kind of a not a big deal thing, all of a sudden is a great piece of film just for that. You know, as George Miller said, just for those two frames.
Yeah, a lot of people say that that's the biggest problem with Selects reels, is that you're getting rid of stuff that you don't know that you still need.
Absolutely. I don't make Select reels.
I'm going to circle back on this idea of how long to make something, and that's like the big car chase scene. You know, how long do you know the audience has had enough of this car chase scene? I remember I was cutting an action scene on a film that my first cut of the action scene was 12 minutes. And I felt really good. Like that's a good 12 minutes. And in the final movie, it's two.
Wow. That's a big difference. But what you're saying is exactly what I was talking about before, where you cut it at first and you love it. You put it into a bigger context and you have to adjust it and you keep adjusting it. I think what's one of the hardest things in editing is to continually feel the arc of the entirety of the story. You have to understand, feel the sub arcs from scene to scene. It's almost like playing multidimensional chess, where you're watching the sub arc of what you're doing, but you're also conscious of how that's fitting into where the audience is as a whole, and watch the movie with the audience and feel how they're feeling, and if they're bored or if they're with you, things like that.
Did you learn anything from any of the screenings that you did with audiences?
On this particular movie, we had no audience screenings. We just showed it a few times to our producers, and that was it. The only other time I've kind of done it, on the first Matrix, we had one audience screening, and that was it. You take a wild gamble when you do that. I think audience screenings can be great, but you get abused a lot, too. I love them. I would love it if it could be just me and the director and maybe a really creative producer watching and trying to make the movie better from it. Sometimes when you have 20 people giving you notes after an audience screening, I have to take a deep breath.
Lots of editors have talked about what they like about audience screenings is just them being in the room with an audience and feeling the lulls, yeah, feeling the happy fit, you know, feeling the power, the excitement when people are sitting forward. You're like, okay, we got them, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's the notes and the cards and all that kind of stuff.
Right. You can get bogged down in the weeds there. Yeah.
I loved the little moment for pacing of I called it the timeout before the big battle. Mm-hmm. He drives and sees his wife,
right,
drawing, right?
She's moved into her new apartment and he's on the street looking into a second floor window.
But I mean, that's a lovely little moment.
It is.
You could have totally cut that out of the movie if you wanted to drop a minute or something.
Exactly.
But what a great, it's a breath. It's a reminder that he's still a human being and he still cares. And
then that's followed by he visits his son's gravestone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They work in tandem.
To some extent, I really like that moment because he'd been played as kind of screwing his wife over in some emotionally, that he just was disconnected from her. And you felt bad for her and like he's not that nice of a guy. And then that moment gave you that sense of, he still loves her. He still wants her.
I always said, like, Godlock is the kind of guy, if he was walking down the street, I'd probably get on the other side. His son's death has just turned him into something that he would want to be. I mean, I think his wife would have been more practical and worked through it as best as she could.
You were talking about sound design, and I loved the sound design in the final battle, you know, as the movie's leading to its conclusion, its finale. The sound design helps the audience actually know where they are in the building. Like, you know, he's getting closer and closer to his final destination by the sound.
Right. Yeah. We already knew that the bad guy, Playa, had his kind of personal quarters in that building. But the way I was editing it, I hadn't actually been in that room yet, but I knew that he was there. I said, let's play this where all of the music is source and it's coming from his penthouse. That'll be how we play the whole thing. I had no experience with what's called EDM, electronic dance music, or house. It's not my kind of thing, you know? But I learned a lot about it. And one of the assistants was pretty well versed in it and introduced me to like Swedish House Mafia, bands like that. Then we found some more obscure bands, partly for budget and partly for interest. Then talking about the sort of the sync up with John Woo, when I finally got up into that room that he actually photographed it. He's got these ceiling to floor speakers on the set. It's almost like you're on the main stage at Coachella. So he was clearly thinking the same thing. Here I thought I had a great idea. But anyway, it's always great to be in sync that way. But you always knew where you were in relation to that, A, the music coming out of there, and B, you kind of established the sound distances very well around that sort of central staircase. Once again, hats off to Mark Steckinger and his guys, and Dave Giammarco mixing it. They really nailed it.
Action is happening multiple places simultaneously. How do you choose when to cut between two things that are happening at the same time, other than scripted? What's driving your edits?
Well, even when it's scripted, there's always a certain amount of latitude. It's a little bit like we were talking before. It's mostly just a feeling and finding a really great moment that will help the cut go across. For example, when the bad guys are coming up the stairs and they hit the tripwire, it was a kind of like this is mano a mano fight between Godlock and the main bad guy, Ruiz. It's mostly just, they're just slugging it out. And frankly, I was getting a little bit tired of it. I thought this would be a good place to get those guys in there, you know? I found a little piece of Joel on one of the takes. I'm not sure if he actually did it on purpose or not. I should ask him. But he starts the take by whipping his head a little bit to the right and then back to Ruiz, you know? In the fight, we went out on a big punch. We see the guys creeping up the stairs. They do the tripwire, giant explosion. Then you cut to Godlock's over the course of like 6-8 frames, his head whips really quick and he lands a knife on the bad guy, you know? So it's almost like he used, you felt that he was using that moment to his advantage.
Yeah, I was going to say the explosion wouldn't have been there for him. Is there a key to going between slow motion and regular speed? Do you find jumping between those two, you know, camera frame rates?
I love doing it, as you probably can see. We started doing a lot of that in The Matrix. There's a movie back when I was an assistant that I liked a lot, directed by Robert Towne, called Personal Best with Mariel Hemingway about running. Those days were pre-digital, and they actually did these things in the camera where they would change the speed as the take was going. The Wachowskis and I used to call those speed apps, like speed aperture. And now you could do that very well digitally. I experiment a lot. Once again, a lot like that George Miller idea of looking at the frames, to scrutinizing them, the connection of how you're going from one speed to another. Do you want to make a gradual ramp? I have done direct cuts from 24 to 96 many times where they're almost invisible, believe it or not. But sometimes you want them to be visible, where you want to feel it acts as almost like a internal cut, you know, because the emotion is continuous, but there's something in there that underlines or punctuates like a really good edit does. I think you have to kind of just love it and want to play with it, you know?
Yeah, I talked to Thelma Schoonmaker about Raging Bull. They did that in Raging Bull with a rheostat on the speed of the camera.
Those were the days of Personal Best, exactly. Raging Bull is a good example.
You mentioned Matrix used those kind of between slow-mo. That's probably one of the most famous, some of the most famous cutting between slow-mo and regular speed is, you know, in The Matrix. Everybody thinks about that for sure.
We all got it from Sam Peckinpah.
Okay.
I mean, The Wild Bunch is one of my personal pantheon movies, you know.
Would you say Wild Bunch was that something that you watched before, like intentionally before The Matrix or no?
It's because I loved it. I'd probably seen it 10 times before I did The Matrix. I love it. It's one of my favorite movies.
Was temping tough because of the tone of the movie or the tone shifts in the movie? Temping music?
No, temping was pretty easy because I wanted to keep it in a kind of a wide but narrow palette. I just found a couple of scores that really, really worked well. United 93. And the other one was the Alexander Desplat score from Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, which I really liked a lot. I think I also used a couple times some Desplat from Birth, which I like a lot as well. Even that and the United 93 score kind of played well together. Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close is about a little boy who loses his mother in the World Trade Center. So it actually flips the whole idea on his head. You know, he's dealing with that. So I just felt instinctively it would be a good place to look.
That is a great idea. Do you do that often when you're trying to figure out temp scores? Because I do. Is you think about the type of movie or you think about the character's arc and go, oh, this has got a similar arc in this other movie.
Absolutely. I love playing with music On Silent Night, because it's a pretty low budget movie, it's like a $15 million movie, we didn't even have a music editor. We had one for the final score, but we didn't have a temp music editor. But I love working with a great temp music editor collaboratively and finding, discovering things like that too. You know, one of the assistants was really good with scores and one was really good with source. And I'm really good at picking.
So the source guy is the one finding the Swedish mafia.
Yeah. That was Sam, and Brent was really terrific with the actual score moments.
Is there anything we haven't touched on about Silent Night that you feel like you want to talk about editorially?
You know, one scene that I'm just proud of in a very functional way, when John and the crew left location, they knew there were a few scenes they hadn't gotten. And they all assumed they were going to go back and do them. It came down to a big fight about money, how many days we're going to go back for. I think there were about 5 or 6 scenes. I managed to work it out so it came down to 3 scenes. But then there was one moment, we call it the separation moment, where Godlock is kind of trapped between the SUV and a motorcycle, and he ends up going down an alley, and they both show up again later. But you had to have the separation moment where he loses the SUV and the motorcycle. That was simply not shot. The closest thing we had was kind of a wide shot. You're kind of behind the vehicles, motorcycles on the right, Godlock's Mustangs in the middle, and the SUVs on the left. And it just kind of dribbles to an end. You know, nothing happens. They don't turn or anything. They never shot the moment. I told them we had to shoot it. But then it was clear they were not going to give the resources that John required to shoot all that stuff. So I really sat down and thought about it really, really hard. Okay, I said, if I was going to shoot that scene, and now I know John Woo, how would we do that scene? I said, well, the first thing we have to do is get rid of the motorcycle, right? So then I thought, there's a great scene later on in the movie where the same motorcycle, luckily, is chasing the bad guys into the garage, and he lays it down to squeeze under the garage door just as it's closing. So we took that piece and we rotoed out the motorcycle. We found something we could use as a clean plate of the street. And then we found stuff of Godlock whipping his wheel from other takes. And we did it all ourselves in the editing room and then turned it over to visual effects, who did a little better. We basically created about 6 shots, literally created them out of bits and pieces of existing shots. And I showed it to John. I said, it's a little bit of a hodgepodge, but I think it could work. He says, fantastic. Love it. Thank you very much.
I bet. That's awesome. Creating something that was not shot.
It was totally not shot. It just did not exist. And it's made of pieces all from the surrounding area. Those are fun things to do. One of the things I love about editing now is that you can do so much. I do so much VFX stuff that is not planned. I'll easily make 300 shots in a movie. You know, very simple things to kind of more complicated split frames and changing performances.
Oh, are you a big split frame guy on a performance?
I like doing that. When I hire assistants, I put together a crew who are good at that because I know I'm going to want to do it. And I also like doing it with my assistants because I always find assistants who A, are good at that, and B, want to edit. I like to work with people who want to edit. They want to do it, and I give them stuff to edit all the time. My little joke, they say, what if I mess it up? I said, if you mess it up, I'll fix it. If it's really good, I'll steal credit. Which is not really true. I like to
No, 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 of course.
But you know, it's so easy with digital now to do that. So when I'm doing it with one of my assistants, then it becomes a back and forth. It becomes a creative conversation. We make it better, maybe even than my original idea. You know, I'll lay it out what I thought I were going to do in that sequence I described. He says, yeah, you know, I remember there was a really cool shot of him whipping the wheel back in scene, you know, 121. Let me show it to you. I think we could use that, you know.
That's the great thing with having the assistants watch all the dailies, right?
So yeah. Like, oh, yeah, yeah.
There's a better take where the motorcycle lays the thing down and it hits a bump, and that would be like hitting the curb or something.
That's right. Exactly.
Zach, thank you so much for joining me on Art of the Cut. And it's been a real pleasure learning about this movie.
Oh, it's really fun. Fun talking, man.
That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, if you'd prefer to read this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors for a Topic-Driven Curated Look at the Craft of Editing. Thanks to Zach Steinberg, ACE, for joining us on Art of the Cut. And thanks to our partner, Boris FX, and to our sponsor, Jump Desktop. Be sure to check them out at borisfx.com and jumpdesktop.com/cut. I'm Steve Hallfish, ACE. Thanks for listening. And please tell all the editors and filmmakers that you know that to get more great Art of the Cut interviews every week, please subscribe on your favorite podcast app.